Sure.
Was that your first time on such a long sea journey?
Yeah. I'd been on a troop ship during the war coming, but that was from Suez to Durban. You know, that was about
2 weeks. So did you fight in Egypt or in Abyssinia?
I was in Italy.
Oh, in Italy, yeah. Were you there?
Wow.
As a RAF pilot?
No, I wasn't a pilot. I was in the South African Air Force Met Service.
Oh, I see.
So I was a werkkundige waarnemer.
Ah. So did you have to then forecast a bit for
operations
purposes?
Over most of Europe from Italy, our planes took off, they raided Poland, they went into Germany and so on.
Have you ever come across Sailor Malan or met him?
I met him when he retired in Kimberley to the Oppenheimer farm.
Oh.
I met him, but he was already ill, you know, he suffered illness. So, there you go. I think this tells you how it came about.
It's wonderful that they kept your wife informed.
Yeah. This was the difference, because the only communication that the Wehrbüro had with my wife was to tell her that I owed them money. So there's a lot there. Then I've saved this. They had a fortnightly broadcast from the BBC. She had to go to Durban and record a message.
Oh,
but the magnetic storms the night the message sounded as though she had severe tonsillitis.
Okay, so how did it happen, just from the beginning, that you went down? They wanted to continue the base, the Royal Society wanted to hand it over to the...
Royal Society wanted to get rid of it as quickly as possible. So these were the logical people to take it over.
The Fitz people.
And
then
they were short of people.
And they needed two more.
They needed two upper air meteorologists. Johan was expert in radio sonde, and I had just been recently trained in this wind-finding radar. But of course, when I got to the Antarctic, I found that they had different equipment from what I'd been trained on. And, you know, that's how it used to go.
Yeah.
A lovely word is slapgat.
Slapgat. Okay, I understand. So who contacted you and told you must go? Was it Schumann or...?
Engelbrecht.
Was
Did
it
you
Engelbrecht?
Ever come across Tollis Engelbrecht?
Yes. Oh, is that what he was called? S.P. Engelbrecht.
Yeah. Seybrand Abraham.
S.R. Engelbrecht. Seybrand Abraham.
He was from this West Coast area. A lovely man. He was head of liaison with the World Met Organization, with the International Geophysical Year. So he had been my boss way back at Germiston Airport, straight after the war.
Okay.
And he asked whether we were interested.
Did
and
you ever?
Johan said, yes, of course. Did I ever?
Meet T.W. Schumann.
Yeah.
Yeah.
T.O. Schumann.
Is that what he was called?
T.O. Schumann. He had more of an academic than an administrative background. He was, well, for a meteorologist, that's where you should be, up in the clouds. and he didn't, in my book, he didn't make the contribution to a strong weather bureau that he could have made. Also, there was a political factor. He had been interned during the war. So he had to unite people like myself who'd been in the Air Force, who was the Royalists, as we were called in those days. And this is where we generated our own hydrogen. And
My grandmother, the sister, was a Royalist, and the family never spoke to her ever again. So he was interned during the war.
And, you know, he had a tough time until 1948 when the Nationalist government took over, and then he was recognized.
Yeah, I somewhere read somebody, Brian Roberts of the Foreign Office in Britain, who wrote that he, Schumann had close ties with Eric Lowe as well. They knew one another personally.
So, I think, you know, ask me all the questions you wish, but I think at your leisure, you're going to pick up a lot more from these
photos.
This I've cherished for years, but it was.
But I guess you went then. You were in Durban, and then what? Did they fly you to Montevideo?
That was a story too. Now, we had to go to Pretoria, to the central medical establishment of the Air Force. We had to go there for a medical checkup. So we get there, both of us, Johan and I. Oh, and we went by train. There was only about 2 weeks available, but because of the tight budget of the Staatsdienst at that time, we went by train, second class. We had the medical checkup, and the nursing sister said, "Now I'm going to give you an anti-cholera inoculation." I said, "What for?" She said, "Alle ouens wat na daai plekke toe gaan, hulle kry hier inspuiting en enting." I said, "But there's no cholera down there." She said, "Look, it's the same as Korea. There's cholera everywhere." So then we went back to Durban to pack up. Now I've got to organize my family and so on. Johan was single, it didn't matter to him.
But you had a school-going child.
Who was 10 years old. Yeah.
But that's your daughter. She was absolutely aware of the fact that her dad's now going to leave to a foreign
her
place.
Her mother was, you know, in a state of shock. So then we flew to London, SAA, and we had 1 week in London before the ship sailed from Southampton. And I had to learn there equipment. Johan had to be trained pardon me, on the British radio sound, which was totally different from the German one which we were using. And so, you know, it wasn't easy. And we didn't know any of these guys. We met them on the dockside. I think there was one I'd met, David Limbert.
But from where did you leave for Antarctica? From
Southampton.
Cape Town. From Southampton.
We had to fly to and fro.
So you flew to London, and there you...
There we met Fuchs, and they'd arranged a program of introduction and familiarization. And then when we met on the Totten, was the first time I'd met most of the people. There was no adaptability or suitability test for any of us. It was a blind date.
You
know what you feel when you're going out on a blind date.
I remember Fuchs calling Hannes Legrandsie a blind date on the Transantarctic expedition.
It was the same with us. But Fuchs had been so impressed with Hannes that when he needed to meet people, first people he asked was South Africa. Because Hannes created such a favourable impression. You see that flag? I've still got it.
What? Oh, you have any idea how precious that is?
I don't know. That's the wind that tore it to shreds.
The Antarctic wind.
Yeah.
For the record.
That flew at Halley Bay.
My goodness. So impressive.
What do I do with it?
Give it to me.
You've got it.
Fantastic. Thank you.
No, really. Oh, this is so impressive.
Fantastic.
Okay, so you only met the men on the ship, the Totten. But that must be one very, very long journey from Southampton to Antarctica.
What was it, 7 or 8 weeks? Because it was a very slow ship. It was a sealer that operated in Newfoundland normally. And it managed about 11 or 12 knots at full speed. So we went down in easy stages to Montevideo. Mm-hmm. That was that was 4 or 5 weeks. One night in Montevideo, and then we went to Port Stanley, Falklands,
mm-hmm.
and we had Christmas there, Christmas 1958. Boxing Day we sailed to South Georgia and refueled and did all sorts of things, and then sailed from South Georgia on New Year's Eve.
But that the seas must have gotten quite rough for such a little
sealer. It did. Some of the guys took to their bunks.
Mm.
And I will tell you that we slept in the forecastle, you know, the front part of the ship, the sharp part. And there were 10 of us in this cabin right up front.
So you did not have anything like a private cabin or anything?
No, the doctor and the leader had a private cabin, which is traditional.
Who was the leader?
George Lush. He was a Royal Navy officer. He'd been before when they built the base for the IGY. Okay.
So you, when the fox, how do you pronounce it? I only know how to spell it.
Totten.
No, the fox, the front part of...
The forecastle.
The forecastle. I know how to spell it, but coming from a phrase that I have no shipping experience whatsoever.
F-O apostrophe C-S-L-E.
Yeah.
It's short for forecastle.
Forecastle. Yeah. Okay. Now I'm learning something. Okay, so, but when it hit the ice, that must have, could you even sleep?
No, we couldn't. It would sound as though the whole ship was being smashed. The structure of the ship was being battered by the ice. You know, you go through bergy bits, which vary in size and density. And one of those hits the stem, the front part of the ship. It reverberates through the whole.
Oh, yes. See, you're invited to a cocktail party and braaivleis.
Yeah.
On the occasion of the visit of to this country of Sir Vivian Fuchs and Sir Edmund Hillary.
And that's when I decided I liked the look of BP because they entertained rather nicely. and that's why I joined BP. I had no future. Look, I had joined the Air Force at the age of 17.
Wow.
I was trained in the Air Force. I had no academic background whatsoever, except learning on the job. And after the war, I was sent on forecasting courses. I was taught physics and mathematics at Pretoria University and so on. But I hadn't done my matric.
Mm.
And so my future in the Weather Bureau as an non-graduate was I just about reached the peak. I became a forecaster at Louis Botha Airport in Durban, and I worked shifts and I saw other people going with their fishing rods and their picnic baskets on a Sunday, and I thought, well, you know, this isn't really for me.
Did you have to write those bilingual exams to show that you can speak Afrikaans and English?
I never wrote any exams. Okay. It was just taken as read. But when I went to Pretoria University for all the lectures were in Afrikaans.
Mm.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, maths and physics
aren't Afrikaans subjects.
It's a big straf. We've got a grandson at Marty's. He's doing law. And he's English speaking. He's got no problem with language. You see, fortunately, as a child, I'd lived in the Platteland.
Oh, okay.
And I had no problem speaking Afrikaans. Mm. It was never a problem to me. And being in the South African forces where it was completely bilingual, I didn't have a problem.
So, you went with this British team. Did you and Johan know one another beforehand?
We were working together at Durban. We were working together.
And on the ship, did you get to learn your teammates for...
Well, some of them never moved from their bunks because this ship
was... seasick. But you didn't get seasick.
But certainly, on a selective basis. You established which ones you had a common sort of outlook on.
Mm.
And you know, the ones that Johan and I took to most were the Scots.
Ah.
The Scottish people.
Interesting.
You see the Scot.
Let me just check this.
And you will see in my photographs, frequently I'm with the Scottish people. And
so, Alibay, it was G.R. Lush was your...
He was the bass leader, Beale.
Mm-hmm.
Blackwell was geophysicist. He was the chief scientist.
Who was the Scot? Was Lim Mace?
No.
He was the cook. What kind of cook was he?
He was an army cook. He liked to call himself a chef.
Oh.
Enough said.
Uh-oh.
Nelson Norman, the medical officer, is a Scot. Mike Sherritt, geophysicist, was a Scot. And Willie Whitehall, diesel electric mechanic, he was a Scot.
Good.
And we got on very well with those. Good. Got on well with Limbert. He died just recently. A lot of these guys are no longer with us. Mick Blackwell, I got on well with him. He was a very good scientist. He was a Cambridge graduate, and that's where most of the British Antarctic people come from.
It's very much a Cambridge
and
still is in a way.
Yeah, because the Scott Polar Research Institute is at Cambridge.
Mm.
The Falkland Islands Fitz, that's at Cambridge, and that's where they draw their major resources from. Personnel resources.
So, on the ship, what did you do when you were not seasick? Did you actually have to work on the ship?
We had to be instructed by George Lush in survival, in safety, in discipline. He was a naval officer, and discipline was important.
So, was he still sort of the officers and the men kind of secret?
Yeah. And you'll see it in that little Scott book.
Wow. It's a handsome chap.
Yeah.
Look at it.
Yes. Oh. You see, personnel.
Nice.
Men, ship's party, and the distinction between officers and men in the British, it's not like that now. But it still existed. And George Lush was a Navy officer, and he was the boss. His knowledge of scientific matters was limited, but boy, he could work and he could enforce discipline, and we had the cleanest hut. Every Saturday was cleaning day and washing and polishing. That's how they grew up in the Navy. You know, they used to say, if it moves, salute it. If it doesn't move, paint it.
So on the ship, you still, I suppose, had to wear shoes and a bow and a tie and so on when you went to dinner.
No.
Not that formal.
No.
Not that formal.
No, this ship, it was Norwegian.
So it was a Norwegian ship that
took
you.
The crew were Norwegian sealers, rough, tough. Not allowed to drink, but ashore at Montevideo, they went overboard. And the doctors, 2 days after we sailed from Montevideo, was healing sore heads and treating them for other
dehydration sorts of things
that they may have
contracted
in Montevideo, because nobody knew where they ended up in the early hours of the morning. You know, these were tough guys. They earn their living killing seals.
When you were on South Georgia, did you see the whaling stations there?
Yeah, Grytviken. You see, he was the first mate, Norwegian guy.
He's like a ruddy guy.
Yeah. Tough. You know, he had a scar right down his back in the tropics when we were going through the tropics. We were stripped to the waist, and somebody asked him what that was. He said, "Oh, that was in a sealing knife fight."
What?
Yeah.
Did they speak English a bit?
The captain did, and one or two others.
Wow.
But a little. We had to adapt to their food on the voyage too.
What did they eat?
Which was rather nice.
Fiskeballen.
Lots of fish. Fiskeballen. Lots of fish. Lots of fish. And great big soups, broth, you know.
Mm.
Thick.
And did you get drinks on the ship? Did they give you some Norwegian wine? Well, they don't have wine anymore.
No, we had our own whiskey.
We had our own whiskey.
So you had whiskey, but the sailors weren't allowed to drink.
It's usually so on ships that the crew isn't allowed alcohol. It's definitely so on the galleys.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Especially after somebody got killed.
Yeah, exactly.
So the captain, can you remember his name?
Hmm? Leif Jakobsen.
Leif Jakobsen.
He was great.
It must be something to steer such a ship through those waters.
And when we were in pack ice, he'd go right up to the top of the crow's nest. And it was a small ship.
Mm.
You can see in pictures of it. And he'd be up there for hours.
Mm.
He had these steel blue eyes. He was a good-looking man, tall, Norwegian. And he would be scanning the horizon to look for a lead, a shoal or a water sky lead. And when we were in the ice, he showed his true skill as a navigator.
Mm.
No, he was good.
So then you arrived in Halley Bay?
About 8 weeks after leaving Southend.
And what did that look like at first, when you came to Antarctica? I mean, can you remember something of your first impressions?
It looked very...
much like that.
That's what it looked like. And we were in a hut 20 feet below the snow surface. That had been built on the surface originally.
Mm.
But that hut had been extended. You could see there were extensions to chimneys for ventilation. And we had to go down. I don't know if you see there.
But did you find it cold in Antarctica?
I was more comfortable in -40, -45 than I am in Fishhook when it's +8.
Okay.
Look, the hut was heated throughout. We maintained 15 degrees.
Oh, that's nice and comfy.
Throughout.
Mm.
The Met people who had to do 3 hourly obs were responsible at night for safety and security, and one of the biggest threats in Antarctica is fire.
Mm-hmm.
You had to make sure that there were no faulty electric connections. We had the Essie type, Aga type slow combustion stove for heating because it was economical. A whole bag of anthracite would last for days, and you had to go around every 3 hours when you did your observation. You did a complete circuit, checked everything, because down there underneath, if a fire had come, we were doomed.
Mm. Yeah, I think you would suffocate.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely.
So there was this one dog.
Did anything ever happen? No, nothing.
No.
And at what point did you meet Fuchs? Only in London?
In London, before we left.
Mm.
He was the boss. We had to be introduced to him, and he had a program for us. And then I met him again when we were back, when he came to Durban. He and Hillary came to Durban. Natal University had a scientific convention, conference, and two of the key keynote speakers were Fuchs and Hillary. Mm.
Were they on friendly terms, Fuchs and Hillary? But there was some competition.
They were different in that Fuchs was a scientist first and foremost, and an explorer second. Hillary was a mountaineer first and foremost. He was not a scientist. He made a big contribution to science, but he didn't have the scientific disciplines
that
Fuchs had.
Yeah.
Fuchs was one of the nicest, one of the greatest guys I've met.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask Piet de Tooy, I think he would say the same.
Yeah, we did ask him, and he said exactly the same thing.
And Hannes Lagrange, Hannes was, hy was a boerseun. Hannes het alles by mekaar gemaak, hier a skroefie en daar a boutie, and on his sledge, if something broke, he'd say, hang on, and he'd go to his sledging box and he'd find a bolt or a nut or something that could fix it. And
that makes that's a useful talent to have when you're exploring.
That is why Fuchs showed a preference for two South Africans, I think. He didn't know us, he hadn't met us.
So, sorry, I interrupted you there when you want to say they had a big scientific conference thing
in
Durban, and it's that with the invitation to the cocktail in Braaivleis. Cocktail in Braaivleis, does it say in there?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
This was after we'd got back.
Did you eat whale meat when you were down?
Had whale steaks. Johan and I met him at Durban Airport.
Were you, immediately upon your return to South Africa, did you go back to Durban?
Yeah, I wasn't charmed with them because I got back and had a month's leave. And then they said to me, well, you're going to Pretoria now for 3 months at the university to brush up your maths and physics.
Mm.
And I thought, hell, you know, I've been away from, I've got a wife and a, by then she was a 12-year-old child. I want to be at home.
Between 10 and 10 and 12, a lot happens to a girl, you know.
So they sent me to Pretoria and I was not very charmed. But then we were meeting.
That is so interesting.
Did you ever, now being in Halle Bay for the year, did you ever communicate with the South Africans of Sanaa 1?
They weren't there yet.
No, but they...
We passed each other.
Okay.
We were coming home, and they were going down.
Oh, okay. So never a point in time where...
So I don't think... I saw Hannes Lagrange once after he'd got back. And he left the Weather Bureau. He went to some other...
Yeah, he went into surveying, city planning and so on.
Yeah.
He was a city planner when he passed.
You know, he was, like myself, one of the people who had not serious academic qualifications. And for us, there was no future there.
Interesting.
Johan Botmar also had no tertiary education, so he became head of climatology, crunching out numbers and things. You know, I didn't see a future for myself crunching numbers.
In Halle Bay, you arrived, and it was an old team that went back under Totten.
There was a big team. They were the Royal Society people.
Mm-hmm.
They were about 20 in number, which was fine because that left a fair amount of space for us.
Mm.
We weren't pushed for space.
Oh, that's nice.
And the Totten brought them back.
How long have they then, by that time, how long have they been in Antarctica?
Some had been there 1 year, some had been there 2 years.
So some of them must have looked quite haggard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think in the photograph somewhere.
Yes. And what did they tell? Did you communicate or talk to one another, and they gave you some tips on surviving and handling the dogs?
We had just this one dog. It was a remnant of dog teams, because at that time they were doing away with dog teams and having tractors and so on. And you didn't really have much opportunity to get to know them, because they were packing up and the weather was bad. The ship had to run for scaling because bad weather cropped up when we were offloading.
Mm-hmm.
And that was serious, because you had to move from the sea ice or the ice shelf about 3 or 4 miles up to the base to get all those supplies safely stored, and then had to get people aboard so that the ship could go and look for a safe anchorage around the other side of the ice shelf. So you really didn't get much opportunity in becoming acquainted.
It sounds like a time where you had to do a lot of things in a very small amount of time.
So quick, and the captain, he says, look, I'm sailing.
Mm.
Whether you're ready or not, I'm not going to risk being here for another year.
Mm. Yeah, because then if the ship's frozen in, then...
That's right.
He said, and the Norwegian crew have to be
sailing,
there.
Yeah.
Okay, then the ship left, and you were left alone. What did you do the first week or so?
We looked at each other and we said, no.
No.
Because then we had to immediately maintain, we had to get stuck in and maintain the records, because Met records go on.
You can't wait for you to start.
And had to learn the new equipment that we'd come to.
Ah, okay. Did you and Johan sometimes speak in Afrikaans to one another?
Mostly.
And then what?
I've got letters here. He still writes to me in Afrikaans.
And then
he never puts a date on that.
And so you put it on when you receive it, letter received. did some of the, I mean, the British and the Scottish people, the English and the Scots, were they interested in the South African history and culture?
Very, very much so.
Did they ask you questions?
The burger got hold of, they interviewed me when I got back, and they got hold of a story which perhaps is a bit unfair. Straight up, say, poor were apartheid. You would hear something on BBC, and usually it was critical of it.
Yeah,
Very seldom did they say anything kind about South Africa.
Well, they
and whether
they
that
never
was
do that. The international press don't like us.
Yeah, whether it was justified or not is not for me to say. But reporter of the Burger asked that very question. I said, yeah, well, there were disputes and discussions. We had to defend whatever we could. We had to justify whatever we could. But here amongst some of my cuttings, straight up say poor were apartheid.
But by 1958, apartheid wasn't really that much entrenched already. I mean, it's been policy for 10 years, but not...
It only
got very bad in the 60s.
Yeah. But when we got back in March 60, there was the...
Sharpeville.
You see, and these things were being reported on the BBC.
Okay.
And it didn't make me sour or bitter or any other sort of thing. This is what I'd been to Scandinavia a few years earlier on a Met study thing. And the same thing. I remember in Stockholm, I was questioned about, they called him Stridum, Stridum, von Stridum, you know.
Lion of the North.
Either you made bad friends through refusing to discuss it, or you tried to stay good friends by discussing and justifying and excusing if you could.
Yeah, yeah.
That could have been a problem, but with us, it never was.
It never was. It sounds like it was more sort of a cordial discussion. Where do you come from? How do you think?
These were educated people, except the cook and the wireless operator. And you know, they were people who were well read and well informed. So you would just discuss it with them on a rational basis. Mm-hmm. You don't get hit up. If you do, you're lost.
Especially if you're just living there with, you 12 people?
And you're in the minority. There are two of you and ten others.
Although I suppose the Scots must have had some sympathy.
Well, they were against the English right from the word go.
That's right.
Well, I think, and somewhere, yeah, I've got a, no, I don't know. I've got lots of things here. I don't know, you go ahead and ask me. I know this is what you were asking about.
Wow.
This is the film we went to see in London before we sailed.
Oh, and there's a sort of a...
It was a BP film, you see.
So BP was very much involved with Antarctica.
BP was, instead of screwing up the environment one way, it was doing it in another way, giving them fuel to burn up on that pristine Antarctic place. But these were the guys. That was the doctor. I have a book which he wrote.
It must have been difficult wearing glasses on Antarctica. No. Don't they freeze to your nose?
I don't think he ever had a problem.
No, he still has such a moustache.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
He was the chief scientist. He was a Scottish diesel mechanic. He was a Scottish physicist.
They all look very young.
Yeah. I was 34. He was older. He was about 2 years older than me. Then I was the next.
And he was the youngest.
He was. He just came from Edinburgh University with a very good physics degree.
Ah.
He was, and he's gone on. I've got. He went on to become a. He's living in Australia now. He had two or three professorships in Australia and Papua New Guinea
and this looks like a radio operator.
He should never have gone because he was totally out of sync with the rest of us. He didn't fit in with the others.
Sevens, but it is.
He used to sit in his radio shack talking all over the world rather than talk to the guys he was living
with. Was he educated or not? No.
You know, he was in the British Army as a cook, he was in the British Army as a radio operator, he was in the British Army, jock, as a diesel mechanic, but he was a musician, he was the one playing the accordion.
So did you sometimes sing a little bit?
Yeah.
Have sing-alongs, sort of British.
He had been there a year before we came. He was in the Royal Society. He was also in the British Met Office. He was British Met Office. David Limbert was British Met Office. Mike Blackwell was also
in the British Met Office. Mm. So did you learn from them about their ways of doing things?
Yeah. And they learned from us too, because we were able to tell them how we operated in temperate climates and that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, because obviously they have a much different climate.
Yes.
And the meteorological data, where did you send it? To Pretoria, to Britain?
Went to Port Stanley.
To Port Stanley.
And then they had this international Met exchange. Melbourne was one place, Melbourne, Australia, and Pretoria was another. And then there was somewhere in South America. So all the data was exchanged by radio. And that was our only form of communication with the outside world. Nobody had a PC or a laptop.
Or Skype. So, but could you speak to your wife once in a blue moon? Nothing.
We were allowed 100 words, which went by Morse code, a month out and 200 words a month in. And she spoke once on the British BBC, which I couldn't hear because of atmospheric and magnetic storms and so on.
So what did a normal day look like? I mean, and summer, the days are extraordinarily long, but it sounds like when you're a meteorologist, you have a very set program.
Every 3 hours, you send off your full observation. Once a day, you'd send off your radio sonde and upper wind finding things. And then the other disciplines, you know, they had to send off geomagnetic and seismological, and that was his job.
But did you sometimes rotate? I mean, you were quite a few meteorological officers.
Yeah.
Or did you all have to work together?
We each was a specialist, really. Mm. David Limbert was specialist in glaciology. He was a meteorologist, but he used to do all the glaciological observations, oceanographic observations. He did geomagnetism, seismology. He did the ozone observations and all-sky camera, aurora, and that sort of thing. And he was a jack of all trades. I had specialized in upper air meteorology, and Johan likewise. But, Hedley was a sort of, he'd been to the Antarctic once or twice, or maybe three times before. He was a professional FIDS guy.
I understand. So he worked for them, basically.
He couldn't settle down, and he'd go back home, and then he'd come back to the Antarctic.
Was he married?
No.
No.
He died, sadly. He was a good mountaineer. He died in a rock climbing accident.
So it sounds like most of you had some contact afterwards.
Yeah.
After your return.
Well, I'm still in contact regularly, until this chap died about a month or two ago. Now I'm in contact with his son, who lives in the UK. This one died recently. I don't know what happened to him. And Nelson Norman, the doctor, I have contact with him. And Johan, of course, regular contact. We phone each other for birthdays and for Midwinter's Day and so on.
About Midwinter's Day, did you have a... I see here you did have a Midwinter celebration.
We had a special menu.
It was a wonderful menu, I looked at it. So that at that time, say for instance at a Midwinter... Yeah, yeah. That people like your leader, I almost want to say, when the ship left, and he's still a leader, but I can't see that he all the time, was he sort of separate, or did he help with things?
He was part of the...
He was one of the boys.
He was part of the everyday activities. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful handyman. He could fix buildings. We had... prefab things that had to be erected. Mm. He did all of those. And he was very much the leader, but Mick Blackwell was the chief scientist. And the scientific programs were coordinated by him. And an interesting thing about this, they asked me whether I would propose a toast to the Queen on the British base. And we got greetings from Her Majesty, from Buckingham Palace.
Really?
You know, forgot to send greetings for Midwinter's Day, Victoria. We got from Melbourne, Australia. We got from all over the world. The Americans down the other side of Antarctica, but Victoria forgot. Anyway, they asked me to propose a toast. So I said, no, I'm going to propose that Johan does it. And Johan did it. And they loved him for that, because they knew he was Afrikaans speaking. And he stood up.
Hail Bronkhorst,
my estate and all I know.
He did it in Afrikaans?
No, in English.
But still. Mm. So who did you toast to as well? I see the loyal toast. What is that?
That's the Queen.
The Queen. They love the Queen, the English.
Well, very nationalist.
Monarchist, yeah.
Royalist, yes. Mm. This is a fantastic menu. Sherry followed by a shrimp cocktail, consomme royal, roast turkey, sage.
Dora, all of those came out of tins or
that's why I'm astounded.
Yeah. And look at all the French wines from 1953.
No, they didn't come out of tins. Talking of wines, I've got to watch now. We've got lots of time.
Was it good wine? Can you remember?
French wine.
Yes, French wine.
Must have been 1953.
So all these things came out of a tin, so you didn't have any fresh meat with you anymore.
We took down with us a few sides of pork that we got at Port Stanley, the Falklands. We didn't have refrigerated storage.
Yeah.
So we had it on the deck. It was fine because when we left South Georgia, the temperatures were around zero or sub-zero, but suddenly a wind from the north came up and these great big chunks of half pigs this side yes. of pork got a little bit off. But when we got down there, we dug a hole in the ice and we put them in there and as we needed them, you cooked away that slight
offishness.
I see this was hand-drawn, this menu. Did one that logo on it? The logo on it, what?
Now, that's the Falkland Islands.
Yeah.
Research and discovery.
You can see the lion and the penguin and...
That is the Falkland
Islands. The guiding light of science. It's very interesting.
One of the chaps, I can't remember who did it.
So what else did you do in your spare time? What spare time you had?
In between the hours of OBS.
It describes his other job, apart from looking after our health, was biology. He did a study on the emperor penguin. He had to bring back embryos of penguin eggs for study.
Were they frozen embryos?
Yeah. You know what happened? Somewhere from the ship to the Falkland Islands head office, they lost them.
Oh, no.
And that, you see, girls, I don't know if you want all this stuff, you take it away.
Well, we bring it back,
keep
definitely.
What you want. This is a paper written by David Limbert. You see, you can have this.
The ozonol. That was discovered above Halley Bay, was it?
Yeah, Halley Bay discovered our year.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Was it in your year that you discovered the ozonol?
But we didn't believe it. They said the instruments were wrong.
Oof. Who discovered it then?
There you go. I'll give you all these things. Keep what you want, what you don't want, you can give back. Where do I want to show you?
So
Simpson, what the hell was he? I remember.
It must be something like, it's GC or something like that.
I met him somewhere. In
he was very much a proponent of mythology and Antarctica.
Yeah, and priestly, GC Simpson.
GC Simpson, yes. And Raymond Priestley.
I met him. I don't know if you want these things.
No, just take a look. So what did you do for fun?
There are more of these things. For fun, the hole in the ozone.
Yeah.
I edited the quarterly magazine. Unfortunately, I haven't got any of them left anymore. And that was one of the things I did.
Oh, okay. So you
edited
the quarterly magazine. What did you do with the magazine? Was it just...
We had one typewriter, no copying facilities, and I had lots of carbon paper. You too young to know about carbon paper.
Well, I've read
Marion
carbon paper. A lot of the documents
and
the archives you read are carbon copies.
And I've got them here. So, there's one.
Oh, my word.
Here they are.
Oh, my goodness. And it just sort of the newsletter for you at the base?
Just to create a bit of...
the Halley Comet. That is so nice.
On with the party.
Look, you see. Are you recording what I'm saying?
Yes.
Don't use it in evidence against me.
We won't.
But here we go. Terugvordering van onkost is aangegaan door FIDS namens meneer G.M. Art. Met verwijzing naar een brief zo en zo en zo. Voorskot tegen salaris. Contant voorskot Montevideo. Verhaal einde maart 1960. Min oorvordering op brieven, op brieftelegrammen. Benevens die bedrag van 13 pond 15 en 2 is die volgende bedrag ook van meneer Oudse Mark 1960 salaris verhaal. Belastingdelgingscertificaat. Verhaal teen voorskot van 10 pond. Toe dacht ek by myself, nee, Gids, ek wil nie vir julle uit.
Kijk.
You know, after...
It's not like it's going to bankrupt them too.
Yeah, you look at the amount.
No, that's the first thing you receive when you get back. That's horrible.
This was our program.
Ah.
Those were all the scientific disciplines.
Glaciology, meteorology, oceanography.
So this was the helicomet was what you edited and then you distributed it around the base.
Yeah.
And
typing it, I used to have to, because you can't make 12 copies. The numbers 9, 10 and 11 you can't read.
Yeah. So, oh, look at this. Did you ever go into the field? I mean, took a tractor and went a bit into the field?
We walked. Sledging report, 1959.
Ah.
We walked with sledges. Solar and terrestrial radiation.
This is so funny. Your horoscope in brief.
Yeah.
Moon subjects. Coming months could see peak buildup. You may reach great heights. General forecast for 1960. Strong indication for long sea voyage for most.
That I was one of the four of us who went on the
sledging journey. Mm-hmm. Did you say you slept outside? What did you take tents
slept
along?
In tents too.
Wow.
Little tents.
And that's the doctor, and that's you. Who's that?
Norman Hedley.
Mm-hmm.
David Limbert, or no? Who was it?
I think the names are in front.
Mm.
Norman, you, Hedley, and Whitehall.
Whitehall. Yeah.
So that one of those.
That would be Whitehall.
Yes, if that was Norman Hedley. Okay, brilliant. And Nescafe instant coffee.
Yeah.
Wonderful. So wasn't it very cold out in a tent in the Antarctic?
It was very cold.
Cool.
And your feet were very cold. Marion will tell you that I still suffer from cold feet.
So you sleep with socks?
Yeah.
The dog, what was the dog's name?
Stumpy.
Stumpy.
Mm.
So was he sort of just your pet?
The last surviving member of a dog team. And he stayed on as a pet.
Ah. Was he a nice pet?
Comfort.
You know when you got hurt for life and everyone else, you go and talk to the dog.
Mm-hmm.
He listened to you.
I can imagine.
And you do get hot for down.
Of what do you get hot for?
Of the isolation, of the monotony. And the doctor writes about it. See, I compiled these sort of things.
So you had, in your spare time, were there books down there? Did you take down your own books?
Books.
Films?
Films. Every Saturday night we had a film show.
Can you remember which of the films you watched?
The one we watched over and over again was The Dam Busters. Then there was another one, Whiskey Galore. But a lot of them were rubbish because they were films that hadn't been a success on the circuit. So they said, oh, let's give them to the guys in their box. You see,
Make yourself a little bit of something to eat for these films?
Yeah, we had it sort of after our Saturday evening meal, which was accompanied by our weekly ration of whiskey or beer. Had lots of rum.
So, rum? Why rum?
Because it's a traditional Navy drink. And in cold weather, it gives you
warmth.
See, these have to be compiled during the year. Accumulation of snow and migration of snow surface features.
This can be very valuable for
survey reports.
Other climatologists.
Physiology. The doctor wrote about the physiology.
Well, did the doctor ever have to work as a doctor?
Were there any ever medical emergencies?
There was one.
What happened?
A chap, one of the chaps got some sort of icicle in a lung. He was outside and it was very, very cold, and he came in, he was having breathing problems, and the doctor said it was some sort of inhalation. So he treated him and fixed it. But we never had a broken arm or a broken ankle like you and I have had in this year.
One of the much more recent doctors, Liz, one of the major problems she had down in Antarctica were dental, actually.
There were one or two dental things, and he attended to those as well because he'd done a crash course on dentistry before he went down.
So to pull teeth and things like that. Wow.
But nothing serious.
And on Sundays, was it a British tradition that you must have some other prayer meeting or church meeting? Not really.
No, just did your own thing, you know, sat quietly, as your own thing. So but Sunday was like any other day because the routine went on
still had
and
to
on.
Work. Didn't the cook prepare anything special on a Sunday?
Saturday evening was a sort of special. Evening meals were well attended. There was always somebody asleep, somebody who'd been on duty all the last night. Mm. So midday meals were not all that well attended. Somebody was outside and he'd come back late for his meal.
But what does a cook do? I mean, cooking is a hard job, but for 12 people you don't have actually to work all day. So what did he do in between?
He baked. We had bread rolls, which he baked and froze.
Oh.
And he had to clean his kitchen. Mm. And once a week you were given what we called gash duty. You were on domestic duty. You helped the cook with the washing of the dishes and with
sort of what you would call in South African skivvy.
Yeah, skivvy, yeah. Mm. And you emptied the buckets, soil buckets and so on. You had a huge hole and you just put them down. And you tidied up generally because... and then you were able to do your own laundry on that day. And at the end of the day you were worn out, like any good housewife is, and you were allowed to have a bath.
So you only were allowed one bath a week?
Yeah. About every 10 days.
Yeah.
Because your turn came around every 10th day. We had a roster for...
for baths.
For domestic duty. On domestic duty day, you...
So, did you ever think, during your domestic duties and everything, that someday there would be women going down to Antarctica?
It wasn't... it didn't bear thinking about. What would I do with women there? They'd be telling me what to do. Nothing has changed.
I heard that.
And the other thing, you had to be tidy. Hoor jy ma?
Ja, ek hoor.
You had a locker that size on the ship. You had a kit bag. In a suitcase you had your civvy clothes, which were down in the hold somewhere. And you had that space, you had to live in that space. All your belongings went in that space. When you were down there, you had a sledging box and you had a locker. You couldn't leave your things lying around like some people I know.
Did you each have your own private room or did you share rooms?
A dormitory. We slept. The diesel mechanic built a little room for himself. Because he had to get up and watch meters and fuel gauges and so on. The leader had his own cabin and the doctor had his own cabin. Other than that, we were, I think, six in one dormitory and four in another, something like that.
But didn't you sometimes wish for a little privacy?
Of course you did.
And what did you do then?
Go and talk to the dog.
I understand. Well, I don't know that much about South Africa in that time, but did you have domestic workers back in South Africa? I mean, didn't you miss somebody to clean everything?
Yeah, did it ourselves. Yes. Okay. Didn't miss them. You couldn't have the luxury of people
coming to work.
Just to clean up for you. You did it yourself.
So, did you sometimes talk about how you miss women? Well, not really.
Well, you avoided it because you're going to make yourself miserable if you talk about it or think about it too much. Funnily enough, among the films we had was one, and at that time, I said, long before your time, there was a report written by a Professor Kinsey, I think his name was, in the United States, the Kinsey report on the behavior of the different sexes and all sorts of things. And we had a copy of this thing.
In Antarctica?
Yeah. And whoever had sent it needed his bloody head read because it's the last thing you want to be reminded of.
Okay. That is a very funny story. So I suppose the mere idea that someday in the future there would be black women in Antarctica was totally incomprehensible.
Well, you know, 1958-59 is 52 years ago. Yeah. And at that time, they hadn't even gone to the moon yet.
Yeah.
You know,
wasn't it during this time that Russia launched Sputnik?
Yeah, it was. Because we used to, on a clear day or night, because remember, we had 3 months of darkness, total darkness. Mm. And in the summer, 3 months of total sunlight. But you'd look up on a clear night and you'd see the Sputnik going by. Mm. Other thing, and it was very, very rare, was to look out for the aurora.
Mm.
But we saw it once. The shout went up, oh, it's there, and we all went up. We had a ladder going down to get into the hut. And we all scrambled up the ladder and stood out there and we watched. And by the time we all got there, it had gone because it's very, very quick.
Mm.
The aurora doesn't stay. It's unfair. It should stay long enough.
That's interesting because someone we spoke to who was on the South African team in the past 2 years said they saw the aurora and it was on there for hours.
You see?
It's a different place.
Yeah.
And also, conditions have changed so, whether it's geomagnetic storms, sun flares, solar flares, whatever, conditions are not what they were. The universe is undergoing huge changes. This planet, I don't know where it's going to end. Girls, you've got to rescue it because nothing I can do anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and conditions, meteorological, geophysical conditions
That's interesting.
Have changed over 50 years. It's one of those things.
During this very long winter, that must have sometimes be a bit be a bit hard to cope with.
You know, it depended a lot on your
interaction.
Interaction with others, and there was music.
Mm.
We had lots of gramophone records. There were no CDs or
DVDs. What kind of music?
It ranged from serious classical music.
Do you have opera?
Yeah, and the doctor was an authority. He played the organ beautifully. We heard him in the cathedral in Port Stanley playing the organ, and music was one of his loves.
So did he also bring some gramophones? So we
had lots of gramophone records, and radio reception was very, very poor, generally. Mm. BBC, World Service, not too bad. Occasionally I'd pick up SABC, and my old mother used to send me messages on SABC. I got some of them, but she was always sending messages. On my birthday, we were sailing. It was en route to Montevideo, and we were celebrating my birthday. And she sent a message. I never received it. Years later, I heard that she'd sent it on what was then Springbok Radio. And she had asked for the request, where is my wandering boy tonight? There was a sea shanty yesterday with a seaman song. So they played, what shall we do with a drunken sailor?
No.
I never heard it. And she was horrified. I said, don't worry, Ma, I never heard it.
Speaking about the Sputnik, did you have any communication with the Russian base at this time at all?
Yeah. They were the other side of the continent. We had regular communication, and especially at midwinter, with everybody except the Argentinians, because the Argentinian base was just next to ours, but they believed that Britain had deprived them of the Falkland Islands, or as they called them, Lilas Malvinas. And they wanted South Georgia, and they wanted the Falklands, and they wanted us to get the hell off there. And they would go in the summer, once or twice, they would go past our base and not even send a greeting. That was the Argentinian, but, and of course, 10, 12 years later, they were at war between the Argentine, the Falklands war.
But did you speak to the Argentinians?
Yeah.
Send them a midwinter message also. No.
There was no communication, but
because
the Americans...
Because I had the Argentinian base on Halley Bay, they're actually within reaching distance.
That's right. Yeah, they were just, they used to go past us.
Oof.
But it was a...
How old was the time?
An emotional, political thing.
Did you celebrate the fact that the treaty was signed? It was signed in December 1959.
We were virtually on our way home, and we heard about this 13-nation treaty, and we didn't know much about it, you know, because we didn't have all the details. We just knew that South Africa was a signatory and so and so and so and so. So one learned about it when you got back.
And when you got back in South Africa, did any minister try to meet you, or any dignitary, any sort of official recognition?
Nothing. A letter to tell me I owed them
money,
£25 or something.
It is quite interesting because, apart from Manus Lekhanati, you were the first South Africans there.
Yeah, Hannes was the first South African to winter. Johan and I were the next two.
And it's actually due to your activity there and the fact that you were there that South Africa was kept in the treaty, because there otherwise had no activity.
We were a participant, and from the information exchange point of view, South Africa is vital.
Yes.
In the global network.
So were you involved in producing that book on Antarctic weather, Antarctic meteorology?
No, I think Lou Hayward of the Weather Bureau, he did it. I know the book.
M.P. van der Rooy and Harry van Leeuwen was also involved.
Yeah, M.P. van Rooy. Yeah. I had the book and I gave it to our son-in-law, is headmaster of a school at Franschhoek. Mm-hmm. And he was geography master before he became head. And he was very interested in these things. So I gave him quite a lot of my Antarctic stuff for use in the school. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know Bridge House School in Frankfurt.
Yes,
his head.
Oh.
Rory Malcolm. So, And all these scientific reports I lent him at some stage, and he gave them to the geography mistress who utilized them. And, you know, that is why I feel uplifted that you are interested in these things. I don't want them to rot in my garage. Look, they're already rotting, like me.
But when you were back in South Africa, the press, it seemed that the press did pick up on quite some of the stories.
The press, certainly in Durban, I had a lot to do with them because they would phone me when I was a forecaster at Louis Botha Airport. They would phone me for information about the weather.
And was Louis Botha Airport Durban?
Yeah, that's the one that they've changed now. It's King Chaka. It was new. Johan and I went there when it was new to set up this upper air thing. And then after Antarctica, I became a forecaster. So the press knew me, and they'd phone and say, what's the outlook for weekend fishing?
Okay.
And the Durban July is next week. What is your long-range weather forecast?
So you already had contacts in the press.
So the press were well disposed to us. And if you look in these scrapbooks and stuff, there is so much from the Natal Mercury.
It's interesting that it's very much...
And Die Burger here... was quite close. We had Alan Crawford was the Port Met officer here, and so the Burger was close to subpolar. It was subpolar activity there, and I think Alan Crawford gave them a lot of assistance.
Yes, he did, and Marsh as well.
Yeah,
were you in contact with him at all?
Alan Crawford, yes, I knew him very well. He was the sort of uncrowned king of Tristan da Cunha. Tristan, incidentally, on our way home, we went in the John Biscoe, it was maiden voyage. And they had a bit of difficulty getting in. Oh boy, what a
after the sealer.
Luxury. I had my own cabin. And we went as far as South Georgia in the Biscoe, and we changed ships there. I can't even remember vaguely. We went back to Port Stanley and back again, and then we had to call at the Shackleton was our ship then. And the Shackleton was going to be chartered for a Marion Island relief by South Africa. So instead of going back to Port Stanley and then to the UK, because that was the only way we could have got home, there was no airline between Montevideo and Cape Town or anything. So instead of going the long route round, we stopped at Tristan and picked up the governor or whatever he was. I don't think he was governor. I think a lesser official, magistrate or something. Picked him up at Tristan and brought him back to Cape Town. Within a year, Tristan had that earthquake.
The
volcano, yeah. So Tristan and Alan Crawford and Day was the name of this magistrate guy. I'm fresh in my memory. We didn't go ashore there. There wasn't time.
Because no, I wanted to ask. There was
never time.
Tristan sounded like such an interesting place.
Yeah. And then a lot of the population left after the volcano. But they went back again. They couldn't adapt. Couldn't live there.
Just a couple of the younger people that stayed behind. But there's now still, 272 inhabitants.
So, if I understand you correctly, you went from Halle Bay in the new ship to Tristan?
To
South Georgia.
And then we left that ship and we came on the Shackleton back again.
So you all went back to Cape Town then?
Yeah.
And then the British
guys, some of them took leave, Jock Whitehall got married in Cape Town. I think there's a thing there about the Hiveluk in Cape Town. And
what, to a girlfriend you had before? Or did
she
you meet
flew
her?
Out. She flew out from Scotland to meet him, and they got married. Yeah.
That sounds so romantic.
And the Berger got hold of that story. It was quite. It's in. Then the others went home by Union Castle.
Oh, okay.
And they loved that. And I had a brother, my late brother was living in Cape Town, and he entertained them quite a lot because I had to go back to Durban. My wife came down to meet me, and we flew back that same day to Durban. We, you know, I had a child there, and all kinds of had to...
What was it like to see your daughter after a year?
You had to re-familiarize yourself with each other because, you know, you at that age...
Things changed so quickly.
You know, she was growing up. Mm. She was 12 years old. And she hadn't seen me for 15 months. So, but we've caught up since then. She lives in France now, and we're in regular contact. Okay.
Is she French-speaking now?
Yeah, she's been there. She worked in foreign affairs, Staatsdienst. She also went to Staatsdienst. and ended up marrying a Frenchman and living in France. She loves it.
Okay, so then you, when you were down on Halle Bay, I mean, 15 months, that is quite a long time. What did you miss about South Africa or about home?
Well, bright place, mm-hmm. Dop and Dum, the things that young South Africans and rugby and, you know.
Bright place, ons kan Chevrolet.
But it never became a sort of nagging longing because there was you had to keep your routine going.
And
the routine is so important.
And when you were back in South Africa, did you miss Antarctica at times?
Not really.
No.
I never regretted having gone. Mm. I benefited intellectually. Not materially, because
£35 afterwards.
And it opened new doors to me. I went to work in BP, and I got a good second start to life.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never regretted it. I was perhaps just a little bit older than I would have liked to be.
Yes.
At 34, you know, 35 was, it was a bit of an upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to be 10 years younger when they offered me the opportunity. But I took the opportunity and I never regretted it.
You earlier referred to you missed rugby, and that made me think, did you ever play sport in Antarctica? I mean, anything?
Play darts. We had no snooker table or anything. Yeah, there was nothing.
Not even a ball to throw around of it?
You can't.
How did you go about getting exercise, or was that just moving around?
Just moving around. Mm. And lots of it. Periodically, you had to go and dig out supply dumps. You had to salvage supply boxes. Coal. You were always digging out coal because we burnt a lot of anthracite.
Each of you had a shovel and...
No, we were there. It was in bags of coal.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three tractors. One burnt out during the war, during the year, because of... before you started up your tractor, you had to put a paraffin heater on underneath it to warm it. Otherwise, it wouldn't start. And you had these start pilot things, the cartridges were starting. And the wind changed, and the tractor blew out. It came back to England where it was repaired and refurbished. So then we had just the two tractors. And all your supplies, you had sledges, had to be dug out of the snow, loaded onto the sledge, tractor driven back to the base, and put into storage, short-term storage for use.
Gosh, it sounds
good. Food. Sugar, we had enough sugar for 20 years. I don't know how it came about.
And cigarettes? Did they give you cigarettes?
We had a free issue of cigarettes. And free issue of beer. Not much beer, because beer is bulky to transport. Mm-hmm. So we had whiskey and rum.
And
took a bottle of Garvey Fee with me, and how they loved it.
I can imagine. And then a couple of bottles of wine.
Yeah, the wine was for sort of Christmas, midwinter, birthdays.
Can you remember what their ration was for rum?
More than enough. We never used it all up. And we were very disciplined, because nothing was locked.
Mm. Really? So
the bar wasn't locked. And whoever was on duty on that day, was his job to open up the bar. He had this very small bar. You can see it in some of them. Mm-hmm. And you'd have one or two. Nobody ever over-consumed. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever took advantage. And that was that. And at night, if you were on duty and you had alcoholic tendencies, it was there.
You could have, if you wanted to.
You could have.
Have some in your coffee if you liked.
Yeah. So, that's one of the things that has stayed with me forever, that sort of self-discipline with your own belongings, with your own...
Mm-hmm. It sounded like you really trusted one another.
Yeah.
Mm. Would you say that that kind of discipline you might have learned from the leader, because he was a Navy man and he was disciplined in that way?
That's right. And I had been in the South African Air Force for five years during the war.
Mm.
So I had become accustomed to self-discipline for a start. And then any other sort of discipline imposed on you is not difficult.
Mm.
As long as you've got the self-discipline for starters.
So, it sounds interesting. So were most of the people there had a military background or not?
Yeah.
Most of them did.
Because in Britain in those days, they had the military service like we had here.
Mm.
And the doctor, before he went down, had done his 2 years or whatever. Or this was part of his 2 years military training. He graduated at Glasgow University and worked for a short while in National Health. They had National Health there. And then this came up, so he did the rest there. The radio operator, the diesel mechanic, the cook, they were all military background. And I think that does help. I know there are different views on military service, but I'm convinced that the transition from writing a matric or going to university would be so much easier if, instead of a gap year floating around the country or around the world at daddy's expense, they were taught some sort of
something.
But I mustn't get onto that, must I? Mark?
Well, they do have similar systems in Germany, for instance. You can choose between the military service or civil service, where you go work in hospitals or whatever. So if you're not the military type, there's other options available.
Now, you know Dick Bonema.
Yes.
Now, Dick came to me. I was at Kimberley. I was an officer in charge of the Met office at Kimberley. Dick was one. There are a few other Hollanders, and one or two Germans were recruited at that time.
Yes.
I think he came about 53 or 54. And his first posting was Kimberley.
Mm-hmm.
And I took Dick under my wing, and I introduced him to people and to customs, because he had come from the Dutch army or the Dutch air force. And he had a good sense of self-discipline. And he was an excellent worker. And he worked with me for about a year. And then he was posted somewhere else. I can't remember. But there was an example of somebody from a foreign country who had sufficient self-discipline to adapt to conditions here. And Kimberley, you know, if you were brought up in Friesland in Nederland, and you come to
that's
Kimberley,
that's diametrically opposite.
you can't imagine it's a bigger contrast. Have you seen him lately?
We've seen him last 2 weeks ago.
Ah, because he had a serious heart condition. And we sort of lost contact for a while.
No, we
he's in Meisenberg, actually.
Yeah, we've been to his home there, and he's been here.
We went to visit him, though, in his home in Swellendam. So I just want to hear a bit more about life on Antarctica. When it's dark the whole time, how does that affect your sleep?
It becomes a problem because, for a start, if you're one of the Met people, you have staggered sleeping hours anyway. But I had experienced that during the war in the Air Force, where so for me it wasn't so great a problem, but sleep rhythm became very irregular, and the doctor writes in that book about the people who came to him for sleeping pills. And he had to guard against addiction.
Yes.
Over-indulging in those things. I did have problems sleeping, especially during that dark period, because you could only just imagine what it would be like to have sunshine again. 3 months of darkness has a depressing effect for a start. And if you're sleeping badly, that adds to the problem.
And then you get more depressed, and then you're sleeping worse.
He writes about depression there, and how he tried to treat it, and how people would go to him. And I wasn't aware of this then, with their problems. And he was one of the youngest.
So he was also sort of a psychologist. About the emperor penguins, were you close to an emperor penguin colony, or did you see them?
Emperor Bay, nearby, was one of the most densely populated emperor penguin rookeries.
So did you go visit it?
Yeah, and the doctor and the other Scotsman actually lived in a tractor box for 6 weeks in the dark, observing penguin bits of penguin biology.
That sounds like a lovely vacation.
There was our little bar, you see. There was our little bar.
Oh, it's very little. We all look so happy to be there. Why are you wearing ties?
That was midwinter. You're all dressed up for midwinter.
I see.
That was the one time in the whole year that you got dressed up. And, of course, when you landed back in Cape Town, we all put on.
Did you shave beforehand? Did you let your beard grow
when
you were down there? So did you shave before you landed?
No.
What did your wife say then about your beard?
She thought it was cool.
So I'm just reading the caption here. Contented members of the sewing bee in the surgery.
Yeah.
So you had to sew your own clothes or mend it and done what? So did you keep these skills of sewing?
Yeah, nowadays, of course, my eyesight isn't so good. I can't thread a needle in.
But through your life.
Yes. Yeah.
And did you sometimes take turns to cook as well?
Yeah.
Or did the cook always cook?
The cook got a day off every 10th day.
And then somebody
else took over. The radio operator seemed to escape this. He was an escapist. He didn't conform.
It sounds like he was not somebody who wanted to be part of the team.
He went to Antarctica as a means of escaping a military posting to Cyprus, because there was war upheaval and unrest in Cyprus. He thought he would go somewhere else, so he went to
Cyprus and Antarctica. I don't think there's more to do on Cyprus than Antarctica.
but so he sat in his radio shack with his key calling up all over the world. But once a week, once every 10 days, you would have a turn at cooking, and I had been given by my mother-in-law a recipe for bubuti. And we didn't have fresh meat naturally, but you had tinned mince meat. You had dehydrated potatoes, which you had to restore or resuscitate, whatever they call it, is a fancy word. And so I would do, and rice, of course.
Did you take the spices for the bubuti along?
The spices from Durban, you know, Durban, the spices took all those things down there. And I think Johan did a bully beef stew or something.
But they must not like your bubuti. Yeah. I mean, the British aren't exactly famous for their cuisine.
Well, you know, with the huge Indian and Pakistani population living in Britain now, they've been introduced to tandoori chicken and...
Nowadays
the Brits probably eat more spicy food than we do.
But it's not their own food, it's
imported. It's because of their...
But when you were there somebody who really could not cook?
I don't think so.
The radio operator did not want to cook evidently.
No, he didn't. But I don't think anybody was totally unable to cook.
And when you came back, what was the first thing you ate? Do you remember? Even on the ship?
Biltong.
Biltong.
Because my family had sent down, in the mail it came. Mm. And the Brits loved it.
The biltong?
It was biltong, you know. So
when the ship came to fetch you, did they send mail on that ship?
Yeah. And it was sorted out. And for days, you know, you'd be going through your mail. It was a bit pointless, really, because you were going to see the writers of those letters within a couple of weeks.
Yeah, even before a reply would get you there anyway.
But it took ages, because our surface mail went from here, or airmail, say, from South Africa to London, London to Montevideo, and then by sea from Montevideo there was one ship a month, the Darwin, which went from Montevideo to Port Stanley, and that would carry supplies and mail and so on. So by the time
the news
you read
was
it,
all
it,
like
it was 6 months old.
But did you send anything back? I mean, did you have postage stamps on Halibut or stamp?
Yeah, I distributed those. And what I had sent back with the guys who... we're coming back from the Royal Society expedition. In Montevideo, I bought leather things. Leather was terrific. Handbag and shoes for my wife and so on. And I'd ordered a nutria fur for the return journey. But we didn't come back via Montevideo, so I saved money out of that thing. I never had the opportunity to go back there again.
Only to pay it back to the government. Did you ever settle this bill?
Oh, I had to settle it. They deducted it from my
salary.
My Solaris check.
So your salary at this time, was it just paid into a bank account? Because obviously you could not buy things.
Paid to my poor wife who battled with it. Wives are not so very good at balancing books, are they?
Your wife.
He digs at me all the time.
Your wife at the time, did she work?
Yes, yeah, that helped. Because our salaries were.
It doesn't sound like you had a big salary at all.
No! We were still in pounds, shilling, and pence.
Continue.
And they charged me for all kinds of things.
Seal reckoning. You charged you for stamps. Nowadays you can just go to the cupboard in the government and take out whatever.
And I was allowed so many days leave when I got back, calculated on 15 months I'd been away, and I said, wat van ziekte verlof, nee?
Word tight. Who was Minister of Transport then?
I think it was Ben Schoeman.
Was it Ben Schoeman? Mm.
But the before we left, Johan and I had to go to Pretoria. I don't know how we fitted all this in. And we had to have an interview with the Secretary for Transport, who was Dani Hubert.
Yes.
And who had been an Olympic athlete.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He'd done really well. He was a world athletic champion, gold cup or gold medal or so. And I think he was bored. He didn't know what to say to us. And he had to do this. This was part of his job. Mm. And his closing comment was, "Julle gaan seker oud weer baard groei, né?" And tot ziens en voorspoed, you know. He was glad that was over. I don't think it was.
It doesn't seem like it was something the state service was very interested in. Civil service.
You see, the people like Trichard, de Toy, Le Grancy, Engelbrecht had a feel for what was happening, but they were not. They were more scientists.
Yeah, they were
than,
not the people
than civil servants.
In charge.
They didn't know the manual off by heart like those guys did. You mag dit doen and you mag nie dit doen. And you know, so it was less of a scientific than a bureaucratic organization. Mm. And I mentioned this to Fuchs.
Ah.
And
what was his reply?
And when he came out, they spoke to him, and he told them how his organization functioned, and it functioned very well.
And what did they reply?
I don't know. I'd left by then.
Okay. Just a little bit more about Schumann, because he did write a couple of letters to the Norwegians for, he wanted to establish a station on Bouvet Island. He was, what was he, more science-minded, bureaucratically minded?
No, he was a scientist.
He
wasn't a bureaucrat. And at the time of the International Geophysical Year, he was still director then, and Engelbrecht was the coordinator, the link with Switzerland, because the WMO was in
Switzerland.
Geneva. And I was working, I had worked with Engelbrecht at Grand Airport just after the war. When I came back from the Air Force, he came back from civil life. He was not a Roy Lissy. But we got on very well.
You and Engelbrecht?
Yeah, got on very well. So much so that one time I was on a tour of the Cape, training lay observers and calibrating instruments and so on. And he employed me when I went to head office. I was in this upper air research thing, and he employed me as his letter writer to Switzerland. And I learned the most flowery language.
Oh, you want to hear it.
And I used to write such things as, "Be assured, dear colleague, of my enduring esteem."
Oh, good.